Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Happy Tuesday, everyone. Really great show for everyone today. We spoke with Lisa Miller and Andrea Gonzalez-Ramirez about their book, Take Up Space, The Unprecedented AOC. We read the comments, we read the emails, and we know that there's a lot of interest in this topic of millennials running for office, this topic of can you affect the political system, how should you best do that? So this interview with Lisa and Andrea, which Sagar couldn't make, about AOC is actually really important. And because people have been asking for a little more commentary back and forth between the two of us, I thought for this episode, we'd just do a quick segue. And I'd ask you, Sagar, some questions about AOC, especially with your DC Inside Baseball media hat on, because these came up during the episode, and I was actually really curious to get your take on this. So if people want the interview with Lisa and Andrea, just skip to it. Or if you want to listen for a few minutes here, we'll talk about all those things. So number one, I asked Lisa and Andrea at this point, which is separate from policy, AOC feels different than most of the other millennial politicians, quote unquote. AOC actually has a following, unlike, let's say, Elise Stefanik, or unlike, you know, Madison Cawthorn. What do you think is unique about her, for good or for ill?
AOC had legitimate stardom. It's hard to describe, and I don't mean that in terms of a value judgment, like I think she's good or bad. It's like with Trump. He simply is somebody who is a star and who understands the ability in order to play the media and all of that against each other. That being said, what's interesting, and I think this is what you guys get into, is she's somebody who transitioned from being that traditional outside-of-the-box star to become a little bit more of a Washington figure. Personally, I actually do think that's a tragic trend. That's not something in the way that it should go. And if I were advising her, that's not exactly what I would say. That being said, I don't really know what exactly she wants. And that's what I think is the interesting question too.
Yeah, that's actually a good way of putting it. What do you think her relationship should be with her need to basically be this political figure, but also the initial authenticity? So something we talk about is at the start, she was doing media hits all over the place. Lisa talks about how she used to have messy plants in the background and her boyfriend would walk through. And now she's transitioned into being very, very, very polished. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, because there's been way less gaffes. She's not getting caught and getting dunked on. But it seems like that authenticity has been missed here. From your Breaking Points hat perspective, like, how do you think politicians should balance those two things?
I think the mistake that she made is that she decided she wanted to play the game, but she's actually not very good at it, and it was never her strong suit. I don't think anybody voted or supports her because she's legitimately good at advancing policy goals. I mean, her chief of staff famously is the one who screwed up the Green New Deal. That being said, the way that she got the Green New Deal on the map is by protesting outside of Pelosi's office and by drawing a ton of media attention. That's all she was really good at. I honestly think gaffes don't matter at all. I don't think getting dunk on by the right also matters at all. I think it only increases her power and her stardom. This is, again, with the Trump thing. I mean, let's be honest, like, Trump can barely speak English and string sentences together. It doesn't matter. It's about the deeper truth and the directional truth to what he's speaking. This goes to what it really means to be a good politician in the 21st century. This can be bleak, but I'm just telling you, like, from a straight up effective political force perspective, that's what she should be doing. Instead, I actually think what happened to her is deeply sad, which is that she let Fox News get into her head. She allowed herself to kind of become the cultural figure that she never wanted to be, which is basically an oppositional young Democrat, if that makes sense. She stopped being something above her own brand and personality, above the Democratic Party, and instead is kind of an apparatchik enforcer. And I'm sorry, but there's a lot of those out there. Did that really need to be her? I just don't think so. So from a pure just like brand perspective, I think that was her biggest screw up.
Man, that's such a good answer, because it gets to a feeling I had during the interview where it's like, look, AOC, I get that you're fighting with Ted Cruz, but Ted Cruz is literally one of the least liked politicians in the country. He almost lost to Beto.
right.
transcend him. And this is your point, right? Because for good or for ill, Trump transcends his opposition. It's why he beat Jeb. It's why he wasn't able to be held back by people in the Republican establishment. By her picking opponents who she couldn't actually vanquish and just get in the muck with. Yeah, that's good. So my last two questions here. Number one would be, you said play the game. And something I said with Lisa and Andrea is, it seems to me what AOC's problem is because there basically aren't any real progressives other than her in the House at a real big number. There's a squad, but they're actually a little more mm-hmm. different than you would think despite the marketing. She's forced to be activist AOC. She's supposed to be media round AOC. She's supposed to be policy AOC. It seems that, but like you said, she should just be being activist AOC, driving the conversation. What are the games that a, let's say, less charismatic progressive could play that AOC just isn't suited for?
She could have been so what she wants to do is try to be the activist and an Elizabeth Warren policy serious figure. This is not in the cards whatsoever. Here's the other thing. She's not very good at it. So, for example, she said during the whole force the vote conversation that she was like, hey, guys, like, you don't understand what's going on behind the scenes. Like, I'm trying to get on this committee, blah, blah, blah. And she just didn't get on the committee. You know why? Pelosi doesn't care about her. She's a junior backbencher from a safe Democratic district. Now, once again, the way that you get real power is not just by attacking the right, but even in terms of attacking the left, is staking out your own territory and forcing other people to react to you. And I think what happened is that she buckled at the end of the day to a lot of the inside Democratic caucus pressure. At the same time, though, I don't know how much I'm just projecting some Republican dynamics, because here's the problem that Democrats have. Democrats like the media. And I mean by that your mean Democratic voter. Your mean Democratic voter loves Joe Biden and they like Nancy Pelosi. Now, a lot of the progressives who are listening to this are like, what are you talking about? You know, people hate them. Yeah, you do. You're not the mean Democratic voter. The mean Democratic voter is like a 55-year-old white dude who's not college educated. So what does that mean? It means that this has always been the biggest problem for the progressive left. Antagonistic politics only work if the broad majority of your base agrees with being antagonistic towards that person. So I do feel for her. In a way, she'd be better in the Republican Party. She'd be a star.
She would be speaker yeah. next year.
Oh, if yeah, 100%.
If you had her level of talent, Michelle Bachmann tried to do what AOC does, right. but she's not talented.
And actually, Michelle got pretty far. I don't know if you
That's
remember.
A good
she
point.
Almost won the Iowa caucuses, like back in 2012? Or maybe she did win. I don't remember. But that's an important dynamic where at the end of the day, AOC does not speak for the majority of the Democratic base. She does speak for an emerging, important electoral Democratic coalition, and especially for kind of an ascendant, culturally progressive force, which is very, very active online. I think she should rep that crew much harder rather than trying to square both sides of the debate. I said this on Breaking Points recently, but the saddest thing about AOC is she's actually just, like I said, a young Democrat. From where'd she go? Boston University. That's pretty boring. I mean, that's just not a compelling thing. She's picking fights with Tucker and wants to get him deplatformed, dunking on Ted Cruz. I mean, okay, like what differentiates you fundamentally from the DSCC, which is the DCCC, which is the Democratic effort to reelect House leaders? Every once in a while, she endorses somebody who is like pro-choice against somebody who's pro-life. I mean, okay, like, once again, you're just a young Dem. I don't see why that's all that compelling.
Yeah, and then the last question, and this was my biggest point of disagreement, because I don't agree with this framing of AOC as being representative of our generation. Lisa and Andrea don't make that claim, so I'm not dunking on them by them saying that, but often you see this framing, and they were talking about how AOC's story with student debt resonates. But something I think about is like, wait a second, like most people, even our generation, don't actually even go to college. So yeah. Even the student debt thing is basic. So once again, this isn't an argument against necessarily changing the way we deal with higher education, but basically like, how do you what do you think are our generation's like issues, quote unquote? Because like my last bit I'll add here, and what I liked about your answer is AOC, like, went to Boston University. She was an activist and she went into Congress. I don't think her experiences, for good or for ill, are particularly representative of her generation and her experience. So
yeah,
that seems to be an issue. But how would you, given like how broad your spectrum is, what are the experiences that could tie together our cohort directionally?
I would just put it in one word, a sense of malaise and feeling like you get screwed over. That actually is something which unites, not student debt specifically, but unites people who are younger and more working class, along with the people who are younger and went to a college. And then even if they did enter the elite, have people who have a lot of student debt, a sense of malaise as a country, a sense of malaise around culture, all of that. I don't know if there is a single politician today, actually, frankly, outside of Trump. And actually, this is an interesting point. You know, young Republicans love Trump. They love him in a way that young Democrats do like AOC, but I don't know if it's connecting in the same way. You see a lot of the younger, more ascendant Republicans, people who are like 25 working class dudes who work out at the gym. They're huge into Trump. And there's a reason for that, which is that it connects to that exact sense of malaise and also obviously political correctness. So her biggest problem is that she speaks like a college Democrat, and that's a huge problem. I mean, I know this is almost a tired take, but colonial, you know, what did she say at the Democratic convention? It was like colonialism, the legacy of IFIA and you know, I'm just like, enough. Oh my God. And look, I think that's her biggest problem. It's just so simple. It's almost boring. Like, she bores me.
Yeah. That's another good answer too, because it gets to our initial frustration of talent like hers should be able to transcend the moment.
Yeah.
And what you just said about generational malaise, that actually transcends things. Oh, that transcends, because this is what ends up happening, the student debt fight. It turns into, oh, like, you think that I need to pay off your graduate degree because you didn't get into the right program. That's not transcendent. What's transcendent is, hey, you took on all this law school debt because you thought you were going to get a good job, and now your firms aren't even offering partner anymore. You didn't even go to college, and you can't even get the right apprenticeship. That is a story which unites different people. Therefore, our generational mission is like, how do we remake the world in a way that doesn't make us feel screwed over? You have the financial, all these different bits, right? Like, this is like well-trod territory for us. But the way you just told it just seems so much more transcendent. It's hard for Tucker and Ted Cruz to dunk on what you just said, even in a progressive framing, than just, I have student debt. People who look and act like me have student debt. This is our number one issue. It sets it up way too easily to be knocked down.
Yeah, I never understand that, which is that you have to talk about it in terms of not just students, but in terms of so many different people. I mean, think about it too, from this perspective. You know, an entire generation of work, you know, arguably, working class young people got way more screwed over by the pandemic than people who were in college. Like, I know Zoom school sucks, and I have a lot of empathy for people who had to go through it, but you're still going to get your four-year college degree. I mean, 2.5 years of lost apprenticeship and entry-level workplace opportunity is a disaster. Like, it's actually really bad in the trades and in other areas where you were supposed to get on-the-job training. I don't see a single Democratic politician talking about that. Not one. And that's an easy way in order to unite it. This is another reason why, I mean, frankly, Biden gets this. This is why, like, even if you are going to cancel student debt, it should really only be up to 10 grand. But it has to be paired with a similar, you know, restructuring of the entire college financing system. But I would argue even a broader debt haul over a lot of young people who have historic levels of credit card debt, car debt, all kinds of entry-level stuff to the American dream. I don't know why it is so difficult for people to understand that 55% of young people in this country don't go to college. That's a lot of people. There's millions of people. The majority. They have no idea what you're talking about. And you want to get bailed out at their expense, or you want to get bailed out while they get nothing? Good luck. I mean, I don't know why this is difficult in order to try and do like a movement that speaks to this. Rhetorically, they'll all acknowledge, but on top of it, it'll always be, and especially Black, POC, BIPOC, young. And I'm just like, you know, shut up. Like, it's not just them. It's everybody who's getting screwed. And look, the more they lean into that, the more they're losing. It's not a secret. A lot of this is really tired ground. That's what I meant. Like, she's so boring. How did that happen? I thought I was excited by her. I don't even like her. But she was a dynamic person. It was interesting.
Yeah. No, once again, lots to think about here if you are a young person thinking about running for office. So that's actually what most of our incoming mail is about. They hear what we're saying and they think it's basically pessimistic. What we're just trying to raise here is, and the way I'm framing this episode is, there are a lot of questions, like you just said. Oh, this is actually good. Thinking about AOC seriously without like partisan lenses, it actually raises more questions than answers. And, you know, I think this is an opportunity for people to figure it out on their own. Okay, well, this is a great intro. Glad we could do this every once in a while. Go to the bookshop to check out Take Up Space, help the publisher, help a bookstore, help us. 2, check out the Substack. 3, of course, send us a tip. And finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network. Let's get into the episode. Lisa, Andrea, welcome to The Realignment.
So happy to be here.
Hi, thank you for having us.
So this is a project by New York Magazine. The two of you write for New York Magazine. So obviously, if you were going to write about a member of Congress, one would guess it'd be a member of Congress in the city of New York. That said, I suspect that even if you were at a more nationally focused publication, not that NYMAG doesn't cover the nation's politics, but if this were just a New York Times recovering everything and everywhere, if you were to write about a millennial politician, you would still write about AOC in a way that we're just not going to see a book about Dan Crenshaw or Madison Cawthorn or Elise Stefanik. Why is AOC that person deserving of a book and a real examination of? I'll throw this to you first, Lisa.
Well, I mean, I love doing the research and the reporting for this book. And one of the things I guess I knew it when it was happening, but what really struck me when I was doing the reporting was that people started asking her if she was going to run for president before she was actually elected to Congress. So she had won her primary, you know, she was 29 years old. She had been a bartender 5 months previously. And she goes on The View and they're like, when are you going to run for president? And her mom's in the audience and everybody's crying. And you're like, okay, this is like, this is a phenomenon that people have never seen before. People, she was so gigantic, like coming out of the gate that, and the way she was elected, the way she won her primary, the all of her like demographic and identity like tags, everything about her, the way she used social media, the way she displayed herself on in advertising and on Facebook was so different from the way anybody had ever been a politician before, that I don't think it was even a hard question. Like, how did she get here? Why is she so sensational? What is she gonna do? How do people feel about her? Like, I just think she's a generational talent and she completely deserving of a biographical treatment.
Mm-hmm. I would like to add that in the introduction, Rebecca Traister writes that she's the first female political wonderkind. And I completely agree. Like, we have not seen a young woman take politics by storm like she has done. You know, we can point at the Kennedys, we can point at Obama, we can point at Clinton. We have a guide to look at men and think that they're political wonderkinds, but we have never seen that with a woman. And she did that. And the fact that she is a woman of color, that, you know, she did not have experience in politics previously, that she had struggles that a ton of people of her generation related to. It just made her a very powerful and interesting character. And obviously, she incites a lot of admiration and a lot of hate. So I think it was like worth exploring that in like a biographical project, like Lisa said.
Yeah, there's so many things I want to dive into here. But let's just start with the generational question. Because this is the area where it's very easy to get hyperbolic and make statements that AOC represents her generation. AOC speaks for specific sets of people. Not that she's ever made that claim, but it's often in the media coverage of it. Part of the problem from my perspective is because of how balkanized politics is, because of the fact that she comes from a specific district, because of the media environment, it doesn't seem to be possible that anyone could effectively speak for anyone. So could you just speak to the idea of candidates, individuals representing cohorts, especially now?
Mm-hmm. She's relatable in the sense, like, I'm a millennial, you know, and when I finished school, I immediately went to grad school because I knew, like, I'm from Puerto Rico and I knew that I was not going to be able to find a job in the industry down there. So we had to do this path. And, you know, you have student debt and you, like, I have so many friends who have finished school and then they did not really start their career until much later because the only jobs that they could find were, like, working in a restaurant like she did, right? So I think that part of it is, like, so relatable, not only to millennial, but to a lot of people who are working class. And I agree, like, not one person can fully represent everyone. And I think with her, like, a lot of people project their ideology and their feelings on her. And that's one of the reasons why she's so divisive for people, right? Because, like, I don't know, like, people expect her to go and, like, immediately fight for Medicare for all, or, like, immediately, you know, introduce legislation to attend to the climate crisis. And she's one person in, like, a body of 400 and some people. And people ascribe her, like, a lot of power in that way. And in many ways, they think, you know, she's, like, a full mirror of who I am. And that, as you said, like, that's not possible in many ways. But I do think that she holds value and in the sense that, you know, I'm a young woman who is Puerto Rican and I had never seen a young Puerto Rican woman in Congress. Like, a lot of Latinas feel the same way. A lot of people who grew up in similar circumstances feel the same way. So she does have that kind of, like, representational value for a lot of people. But I do agree that she's not the only person we should be looking at. And I think that the way that she understands politics, like, she sees herself as, like, someone who, like, we should not be putting all of our hopes and dreams for the future of the country on one single person. And I think that's the way that she's practiced as a, like, a, as an organizer and also, like, a politician. But it's inevitable that, like, this country is obsessed with, like, messianic figures, right? And, like, putting all this energy into one single person and hoping that they will fix every problem when the reality is, like, it takes movements to do that. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it does, and it gets at. And a good interview leads to more follow-ups. I have things I'll follow up on, but Lisa, I'd love to bring you in if you have anything to add.
I mean, I think that... a couple of things. One is that, to me, the way she talks is so to her generation. And by that, I mean how she uses words, you know, how she just talks in normal conversation, how she uses social media, the way she lives transparently, especially at the beginning on Instagram Live, where she was showing you her apartment. And she was showing you herself cooking. And she was, you were listening to the music that she was listening to as she was cooking. There was something like, you know, the big aspiration in social media, right, is relatable, but there was something so relatable about the way she presented herself in public that made her, that took down the wall between, like, the politicians and the people. She really made you feel this was her skill, but it was also her generation. She really made you feel like you were her friend, and not in a fake way, but in an authentic way. And that brought in people who had been alienated from politics, who didn't like being talked down to, who didn't like being condescended to, who didn't like being told that they were going to get something and then not get it. And that kind of authenticity, was so powerful, especially at the beginning. Like, Her clothes didn't look like politician clothes. Like, nothing about her looked like what you would expect, even from a Democratic challenger in a primary. And I just think that, like, Bernie started it. Bernie started this outreach to young people by talking about, you know, moral principles and the corruption of corporate money in politics, and like the need to purify the process. But she kind of took over from him and infused it with, you know, I am not of her generation, but like a generational way of talking about problems, like in a moral frame, that was super appealing to people who felt like alienated and not part of the process, that the process hadn't been working for them. So I really think that, you know, at the beginning, what she gave us was a kind of authenticity and a regularness that was absolutely powerful, like super powerful.
So a couple broad questions here. Andrea, to push back on something a tiny bit, I'm fascinated by the discussion around student debt, college attendance, et cetera, because the show is called The Realignment, and a realignment in our political system right now is that at a real core level, you're seeing these real higher education driven gaps between political party identification. Mm-hmm. So you referenced the Kennedys, for example. It's interesting. I'm reading a book about JFK, and I'm at the part where he's about to run for Congress in 1946, and he's a millennial. He's the son of a Wall Street financier, former ambassador to Great Britain, you know, all these things that make him totally out of touch with your actual voter. Yet at the same time, he was drafted and served in World War II, and he, his brother was killed in the war. So he actually, at a generational level, there was this like big uniting experience. So could you talk a bit about the student debt issue? Because I just know like a lot of Republicans who listen to the show, who I've just frankly spoken with, they at a generational level just don't care about student debt. They're like, that is a thing for upper middle class professionals or people who work in journalism the way we do. And that just isn't actually our experience. And it seems to me AOC's problem, and this is a broader problem for the progressive left, is how do you escape from that 33 to 40% mm-hmm. part of the Democratic base that Bernie was unable to escape from? And to me, it seems that right now AOC is not able to escape from either. So this is just the broad dynamic around this.
Yeah. So I think that the reason like a lot of people deeply care about this issue, right, is because student debt can really derail your life in a way that, for example, like my partner and I, we are in our 30s and we're probably not going to buy a house for a little bit, right? We left New York in order to live in a more affordable city. And one of the reasonings was that like, hopefully this will help us make a dent so we can, you know, get our life started in that sense, right? And that, you know, it impacts so many people, not only in industries like media, right? Or like, or high other higher education, like degrees that people see as like, oh, you know, you go to a liberal arts college and of course you're gonna come out with a ton of student debt and no job. So I think that in a way for a lot of people in America, like, our generation grew up with this idea that you go to college, or like if you were in a middle class household, or if you were in a working class household, that, you know, you were trying to get out of that socioeconomic status. The idea was like, you go to college and you get your degree and then you're going to be guaranteed a job. And then that kind of promise like disappeared into thin air, right? With like all the way that the economic crisis happened like over a decade ago. And it just feels very like you cannot have the life that you would like to have because you like, you know, a ton of your money is going to this debt that you were acquiring when you're an 18-year-old and you were not really sure what the hell you were doing, right? But I completely understand why some people push back against that issue and don't see it as like an urgent matter, because it does seem like it was a decision you made, right? So you take responsibility. But I think we forget that in many ways, like we're talking about like as Lisa said, the framing for people who support AOC is like, this is a moral issue and you should be able to have a future without, you know, feeling bogged down and having to make all this like this financial decisions of like, oh, well, I want to have a kid, but I have to wait 10 more years, right? And then I wait 10 more years and I'm probably not going to be able to have a kid then, right? It just feels like a very real disconnect between the real lives of people and then like the imaginary of like who was the person holding students up.
I mean, if you don't mind,
follow up.
this is the existential question of AOC, right? Is like her moral purity, her principles are what got her elected and are what created, you know, basically a political fandom like mm-hmm. we've never seen before. And so the existential question for her is like, is she that person? Is she this avatar, this kind of avatar for like leftist purity? Mm-hmm. And in order to draw the fire and stand up, you know, for her, for what she believes in and keep asserting like the moral lines, or is she actually a politician? Mm-hmm. In which case she has to like deal with like when in the Congress into which she was elected, there was a significant number of her colleagues who were centrist Democrats who had taken seats from Republicans. Those people were super vulnerable to anything that sounded like socialism, defund the police, college debt. You know, I mean, this is the Joe Manchin problem. And this is real politics. This is like what it's like in Congress. And so I think that that question for her is like the, and for all of us actually, is like the center of it. Like, what does she do? Does she, you know, stand up and be this like lightning rod? And is that her function for our political sphere? Or is she gonna like compromise and do deals and take less and say it's okay? And where is she gonna draw her lines? And where is she going to insist on staking out an unpopular position and pissing off her colleagues in Congress who need to keep their seats? Like, this is an existential threat for her. And I think that's part of what makes her rise and her present state like so flammable. Mm-hmm.
I would like to add one
final thing. Keep the thing going.
Yeah. And I also think that no matter how she negotiates that, like, she's already a brand. And I think that the Republican Party and conservatives really latched on to her in a way that we had not. Well, we only had seen with people like Hillary Clinton, right? Or to an extent, Nancy Pelosi. And no matter how she, what she says, right? Whether she comes out and she's like, defund the police, absolutely abolish ICE. Or she is like, well, maybe like, you know, like in the book, there's this part where she's during the campaign, the 2020 presidential campaign, she had this sense of like, well, if we don't get Medicare for all, like in the compromise is getting a public option, like that's good for me, right? And that sounds like a compromise, but no matter what she says, like, people already decided what she represents. So she's still like an existential threat to a lot of her colleagues because she cannot, to an extent, she cannot win, right? Because again, she's like this avatar in which people project a lot of these things, which is like a really complicated position to be in. And I'm like, I don't think anyone would want to be in her shoes in that sense.
I'm so happy that the two of you framed your responses that way because look, this is an episode that's pretty much dedicated to a lot of the members of the audience who are writing in, hey, I want to run for office. Like, should I not? Is the system toxic? And Lisa, I love your framing of this is the existential question for her, because it seems to me that based on what the two of you are saying, if you think about running for office, you'd think like the existential question is like, what are the exact planks of the Green New Deal? What are the ways that this policy or that policy operates? But it seems the actual structural question is one that you're raising. So for example, Andrea, you just said she has a brand. She has a brand, and brands, successful brands, polarize. Pepsi, Coke, like that's a thing. And Lisa, to your point, that brand is built on authenticity. But that being said, she's done all these things that she's still polarized. Like, you know, my little mini role in the AOC story is that I worked at PBS back in 2019. So I was there literally on set when the firing line debacle happened. I'll just tell a quick story because people on the right get mad at me when I say I like AOC, and it's because what basically happened was we reached out to her to go on the show, and initially like there was a rejection from her staff because like why go on a show? You just got elected. It's not particularly useful. You're, like you said, you weren't even in office yet. It's not great to be debating ideas. They say no, and then they follow up a day or two later and they're like, hey, like AOC actually like heard the pitch and wants to do this show. So whenever people on the right are like, man, like she's so dumb and like the quotes weren't right and she didn't have a good articulation of Israel-Palestine issues, part of me is sort of just like, man, like, but it was authentic for her to want to go on. And I really respect the hell out of that. And I think that's the type of thing. We hate when politicians are all like talking pointed and they go on Meet the Press. But when you do that, you're hurt. So how do you, so this is the existential question. How do you be authentic while also not hyperpolarizing yourself to the point where the Green New Deal is just a non-starter? I don't see any way out of that. A non-starter from the perspective of like, let's just say the next few Congresses, especially if Republicans do well in the midterms. It's a toxic issue on the right.
I mean, I think to Andrea's point, like she's stuck, right? Because no matter at this point, you know, no matter what she does, the right is going to use her as their prop to, you know, drum up hate and loathing for all every left policy there is, no matter, like, it's kind of hopeless in that way. But what I wanted to say about the firing line episode was that you never see a politician look that vulnerable. Like she really did not know how to handle herself, even how to sit, even how to, you know, lean into the conversation. Like she was the new girl, 100%. And, you know, you can like that, you can say she was unprepared, you can analyze that however you want. One of the things that I've noticed about her recently is that phase of her life is completely over. Mm-hmm. And she is so on point, and she is so, her message is so clean. And you notice that, like, when she's speaking in public, like, all of her home furnishings are gone. All of her, you know, her furniture is gone. The idea that, like, her boyfriend might be walking through the frame in some, like, part of the house is gone. You have the feeling that somebody is talking into her ear and, like, helping her, you know, manage her responses to things. Like, she is already so much less authentic and so much more packaged than she was at the beginning that I don't know how she gets out of that box, especially when she's
Are you suggesting that's a bad thing?
I mean, I think she like it's, I'm not suggesting good or bad. I'm saying like, she's had this job now for 3 years and she's gotten really good at it. And she was in the Capitol on January 6th and the mobs were coming for her. And there's a requirement of like safety and protection that she actually has to live with day to day. And like all of that has, and you know, she gets death threats like regularly, like all of that has required her to become much more boxed in real life than she was previously. And, you know, I don't know what the solution is for her. I'm, as Andrea says, I'm like really glad I'm not her and having to figure it out because
we get to write and talk about it, not actually. Right. Right. It's great. It's a great peanut gallery.
And then show you guys my messy house and not worry about it, right? Like,
so let me throw this to you, Andrea. Because I was reading a chapter about in the book about Saikat Chakrabarty, who was her initial, frankly, like empirically disastrous chief of staff, regardless of your views on policy or not, was just, and he says this, was not suited for the job, did not want the job, took the job. That's another side story about millennials engaging of politics and frustration, which is I think the undercurrent of this entire discussion. But initially, they talk about how she said no to the Sunday shows. She said yes to Jacobin. She said yes to going on a Showtime show. How do you, and this is difficult, right? Because we're journalists. So it's in our incentive to say, oh, of course, come on our show. Of course you should do Firing Line. When obviously like it was a mistake. The comm staffer was correct that she should not have done Firing Line. She literally, even if the appearance had gone well, would have gotten zero from it. I hope my Firing Line bosses are not listening to this episode, but just don't. But so like, how do you think of how young people who want to speak, like, should you go on TV? Should you go on shows? Like, what's the use?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I know that being interviewed by a journalist sucks. Like, I'm very aware that, like, you know, being on the other side, like, there's a reason why I do this and I don't do anything else that would require being covered by the media. You know, if I'm gonna be in the media, we're gonna like have a conversation like the one we're gonna have we're having right now. But you know, I think that you have to be strategic, and when you're starting out, and like the team she had at that time was a team of outsiders, right? It was not like a team of people who had been in The Hill for decades and like were super hyper aware of like how to package stuff and how to like message stuff, right? They were kind of like the rebels coming in to like implode whatever system existed at that point. So for her to negotiate that of like, you know, you can use social media and you can use Instagram Live and you can use your Twitter. And of course she has like an insane following in all of these platforms, but Is that good for you politically, right? Like, are you trying to reach just your district and people who align themselves with your politics? Or are you trying to reach even more people? And I think that goes back to the question of like, when people ask her, like, do you want to run for president? That's like a calculation that I imagine she asks herself. Like she says all the time that she's maybe just going to disappear and go open like a camp compound or like in the middle of nowhere, right? Which I think is very relatable to many of us, just like disappear, no social media, just, you know, us tending to land. But for a lot of people, like, you know, I think it's a question that when you make the decision of run for office and be a public figure and all the insanity that comes with that, it's just like, what is your message? What is your ambition? And also, who are you trying to reach? And unfortunately, because of the way that we're designed right now, going on TV, talking to the New York Times, talking to your magazine, right? Like these things are still necessary if you want to break out of like your echo chamber to an extent and reach other people. But it sucks. I'm not going to say it doesn't.
I find that her use of media is actually really strategic. Like mainstream media is very strategic. Like when she has an idea she wants to float, she frequently goes on Chris Hayes. Like Chris Hayes likes
smart
her.
Talking head, interested in
ideas.
Yeah,
he's sympathetic to her. You feel he'll ask her some hard questions, but it's a, you know, it's a safe room for her. She wants to float something like a change, like an incremental change in position or stance. She'll like do it there. She's at the beginning, you know, she was at the very beginning, she was talking mostly to local press, and some socialist press, but then immediately she did the New Yorker, Vogue, New York Magazine. Like she did sort of this run of high-end elite, like national, media outlets in order to say, like, I'm here, like, I'm going to establish my national credibility in these, you know, outlets. That was extremely well thought out and executed. There were people locally who were like, you know, don't go so fast, little girl, like, stay local, talk to your people. And she was like, you know, no, this is who I am. So she does make missteps, but I think, like, her use of media is more strategic than, you know, any politician I've ever seen. Like, she is completely in control of who she's talking to, when, and to serve what ends.
I would say too, that at the beginning, like, no one was really covering her, right? Like, I did speak with her before her primary for Refinery 29, which is like a women's media outlet, right? And it was only local press and social press because the big players were not interested. Like, for like the night of the primary, like, the New York Times sent their reporter to Crowley's election party, but sent a freelancer to her party. Like, you know, like, when she won, like, there were barely any cameras there because no one thought, I mean, how could you, right? Like, it was like, it was such a situation where the impossibility of it was obvious, right? Like, she's not gonna win. I mean, I covered her and I told my editor, really interesting. Like, you know, it was this wave of women we were covering. It's like, she's so interesting, but, like, what are the chances? Because I don't know. It's like, this man is extremely powerful, has been in office forever. Like, you know, and then she just bucked that trend completely, right? So I think that was one of the reasons why she was, like, so embedded with this, like, smaller, like, outlets. And then as she came into her power, then she just chose to be very strategic. She just says, her team says no frequently to stuff. Okay. I would know. Like, I would know. Every outlet I've been in, I've reached out at some point to her team, and, like, I barely received any yeses because she's just super, super strategic.
And this is what happens if you do not respond. People will write a book about you. So everyone can do things. Do either of you know off the top of your head the Cards Against Humanity story at the start of the book?
I don't know the story about the card, no.
It's so okay. This is one of those things where I was going to let you tell it. But I usually, quotes at the start of a book don't really mean anything, but this one, like, really, really meant something. If people get the book, just read my recommendation is just, like, obviously read the whole book, but the first chapter, like you said, Andrea, is just really huge. So it talks about their interview. It was an interview with the founder of Cards Against Humanity, and he was talking about how in 2019 he created a card for AOC. And he said there was also a card for Steve Bannon, just because it's Cards Against Humanity, it's polarizing, you're going to talk about these things. His point, though, to AOC's relevance is he thinks in 10 years, that Steve Bannon card is going to look kind of like very, very of the moment, like having a Michael Avenatti card in 2018, RIP on a couple of different levels. But in 2028, you would look at an AOC card and say, hey, like, she's the senator, or she's thinking about running for office, or she's launched a big podcast in her office, this, and that. Steve Bannon would not be similar. My reaction to this, though, and I'd love to hear your responses, though, is yes. Like, Steve Bannon as an individual, moral judgments aside, is not going to age into the 2020s in the same way that AOC does. He is not going to be, he's not the figure he was in 2017. He won't be the figure he is now in 2030. That said, his ideas, the degree to which he played a role in actually making them certain, but his vision for what the Republican Party would become, on basically every single count, whether it's the way the Republican media ecosystem works, whether it's Republicans' positions towards Russia and Ukraine, China, immigration, economic policy, even the language, he won the board. And the Republican Party of 2028 will look more like him than it did look like Jeb Bush in 2015. With AOC, she will be more famous than him, but I'm not sure the Democratic Party will look more like her. And that seems to be the contradiction within that opening quote. I'd love to hear both of your responses, starting with Lisa, because that was just my insight. I was like, yeah, AOC will probably be referenced in history books more of the early 21st century. But I think Bannon may for good or for ill, play a bigger role in defining the actual party that he was a member of?
I think you're making an apples to oranges comparison, actually. Like AOC may not be remembered in 10 years for the way she manipulated the rhetoric of her party, but as Bannon will be, or the policies, but she will 100% be remembered for creating a path for women, creating a path for people of color, creating a path for working class candidates, creating a path for progressive normalizing. I mean, one of the huge things that she did was to normalize progressive policies that 4 years before she entered Congress were thought of, 2 years were thought of as like radical policies. She made all of that sound extremely normal and like stuff that was reasonable to want. She is definitely following in Bernie's footsteps, but she is using that language, and she has normalized the need for healthcare, for student loan reform, for new policies with regard to climate change. Like, the list goes on and on and on. Stuff that we're allowed to talk about as normal things to want, as Andrea was saying earlier, that were thought of as like insane radical socialist ideas previously. And so I think as an example of a kind of person who's acceptable to be in Congress, and also as an example of somebody who's talking about dignity and equity in ways that that don't seem either sort of kumbaya-ish, like liberal happy talk. I think that her influence has been undisputable.
A quick follow-up, Lisa, to your apples and oranges point. Steve Bannon explicitly set out trying to do what I described him as doing.
Yeah.
So the obvious question then is, what does AOC want then, right? Because I should be judging her success based on what her is her goal to create pathways. Like, what would you say her goal is then within this framework?
She says over and over and over and over again, like, we need a machine muffin movement. She wants to be in this together with the people, like speaking truth to power. It's like, it feels really clear to me.
Sorry, Andrea, please come in. And I turn my eyes towards you, but I realize that Zoom, no, it doesn't quite work the same degree.
So everything, I agree with everything Lisa was saying. And I think to an extent, her mark, she was part of Biden's climate committee when he was coming in. And, you know, the plan that came out of that was basically the Green New Deal without the name Green New Deal, right? So she is influencing policy, and she's allowing, you know, other people to believe that it's possible for them to run for office, you know, if you are a queer woman, or if you're like super young, or, you know, if you were a bartender like her, right? But I think that she also talks about the Overton window, and like that her purpose is just to push it. So this ideas that 5 years, 4, 3 years ago seemed like extremely radical become much more normalized. And in that, she has been successful. Like, we talk about a lot of the policies that she amplifies as policies that we should talk about, right? Like, there's no like, oh, that's crazy, why you even bring it up? Like, a few years ago, something like the Green New Deal, right? Like, it would be like, what the hell is that? And okay, whatever. And ever since she came into office, like, it's become part of like our mainstream language. So in that, she has been successful. I don't know if the Democratic Party is ever gonna fully look like her in terms of like where she stands, right? She has said before that if, you know, in any other country of the world, like, her and someone like Joe Biden would not be in the same party, because like this two-party system just lumps people together in a way that doesn't happen in other places, right? So that, I think that there's tension there, but I don't think that's like where her energies are fully going. Like, yes, that's part of what she does, but like, I think she's more much interested in normalizing a lot of the things that seemed pretty radical a few years ago that don't seem radical anymore.
Yeah, and that's really fair. And it's kind of interesting because if you're talking about the two-party system, like the Democratic Party and the Republican Party face different issues. So if you're Steve mm-hmm. Bannon, your argument is, hey, Jeb Bush is not representative of what the actual Republican voting base feels. It looks much more like Trump, once again, for mm-hmm. good or for ill. If you're AOC, to your point, the issue would be that Democrats, especially during the Obama era, were very constrained in their vision of what could be done, like the public option, right? If we're talking about mm-hmm. what's seen as radical, the if it's 2009, the public option is just like, I remember reading Newsweek back in high school, and it's just like, ah, it's like, you know, it's insanity. This was five Newsweeks ago for people who are like, why are you reading Newsweek, Marshall? But basically on a deeper, that was sort of rude, but whatever. I liked previous not, you know, bought out by various private equity groups and, you know, separate whole other conversation. Marshall's fraught relationship with high school Aaron. But to the actual conversation here, I want to reflect something that we in the audience have been speaking about, which is that I asked my girlfriend today, like, what she just thought about all this. And she just said, like, I feel like politics is just toxic and depressing. And that's how I honestly feel about this. And my kind of reaction to hearing AOC's talent is part of me wants to say, like, man, like, a world that would have been better for her, maybe not for her ideas, but better for her, is one where she gets really close to Crowley, but she loses, and then everyone sees how talented she is. And then she doesn't have to enter into defund the police debates. She doesn't have to enter into Latina versus Latinx. She doesn't have to dive into Joe Rogan misinformation, like all these toxic culture war issues that, from my perspective, just anyone who touches them loses their ability to build a consensus. Like, that's just my like honest reaction is, like, looking at this, I'm like, man, like, I would not want to be a politician during the 2020s because the culture war eats everything. Like, how crazy is it that the Green New Deal is like technically a culture war issue? So I would just love people get, Lisa, you're shaking your head at my cynicism. This is audio only, but you've called yourself up to the stage. Seriously, like, please, like, cause this is depressing. I don't like saying what I'm saying. So push back, please.
No, I mean, I guess I just think, like, I'm so happy she's there for us. And you can, you know, you can say, like, you can argue, people have argued that her insistence on defund was an error. That, in fact, a lot of people don't want defund, that it was bad for her Democratic colleagues, that she insisted on it past the point where it was like actually a thing that people were saying. And yet I really appreciate her insistence. Like, I think that her determination to rise above is so important and moving, even when she's making mistakes or is wrong or is like running afoul of her colleagues in Congress. Like, I just think we need North Stars. We need a compass. We need people saying, like, I mean, one of the things she says over and over, like, if you listen to a lot of her speeches, is like, she sounds like a little kid almost. She's like, that's just wrong. She says, that's just wrong. And you're like, thank you. Like, thank you for saying that. Thank you for like insisting on that. Thank you for not moving off of that. And, you know, I guess I feel like politics needs all kinds of people. Politics needs people who, you know, needs the Pelosi's who are in the back rooms, like twisting arms and like, you know, making deals. And it needs the Ocasio-Cortez's who are like standing up and being fire and saying like, this is what's right. And, you know, one of her great mentors and idols is Barbara Lee. And she reveres Barbara Lee, who's, I don't know, been in Congress for, I don't know how many years, decades for sure. And she was one of the, she was the only person who voted against this law that allowed, that she felt allowed presidents to wage foreign wars without congressional approval. And everybody hated her. Oh, it was during the Iraq War. And she, everybody hated her for it. Everybody reviled her for it. And AOC went to her in her earliest days in Congress and said, like, how did you stand it? How did you stand being so hated, so reviled, so like uncollegial and disappointing to everybody? And she was like, you just put your stake, and Barbara Lee said, you know, you just put your stake in the ground and eventually everybody moves to you. And that may not be true. Like, everybody's not going to move to AOC, right? But for me, as an American, as a voter, it's really great to have somebody who's representing that side and who's like speaking the truth to power. And I, it's got to be a hard job. It's got to be a really, really hard job, increasingly hard.
I don't think it was going to ever be in her DNA to move away from this like hard issues, right? Like, I think that the way that she was raised and the spaces in which she was raised and like this consciousness she had growing up, you know, she was in a pretty well-off community, but her family was not well-off, right? Like, her mom was cleaning toilets. She hung out with like immigrants that came over to drink coffee. And she grew up with like this, I think, I guess, a very passionate person who was very, this is right, this is wrong. So it was never going to be in her DNA to shy away from those issues. To Lisa's point, I spoke with Barbara Lee like last fall, and you know, she was so hated when she voted no. This was just a few days after 9/11, so the entire country wanted, you know, they wanted like to feel the retribution to an extent, right? And they wanted to make people pay for what had happened. And Barbara Lee saw, she had the long view, and she was like, no, this means that if we vote yes now, like, who's to say what's going to happen with any other president from now on? She received death threats. She had to have security, like, you know, every day, every single minute, she was surrounded by people because she was extremely hated. And now 20 years later, we see like she made the right call, right? So I think that for AOC, she was deeply attracted to that sort of, I don't know, it goes back to like the moral, what's moral. And for her, you know, she's stands there very strongly, even though, you know, she's extremely hated by some and also extremely loved in a way that must feel like crazy and weird and, you know, like almost like you're being stripped of your humanity, right? Like the people who know her, the people who loved her, but we presume to know her just because she's in the public eye in the way that she is. So yeah, I just wanted to add that.
No, and that's, and this is what's fascinating, because as you two are describing this, my immediate reaction is, it seems like so much of what causes trouble for people like AOC on the left, especially the hyper online left, I'm not pretending this is a particularly like large group of people, but it's a very vocal one. Audience members know who I'm referring to, is it's not quite clear what they want from politicians like AOC, because it's like you said, both of you two really eloquently made this point. They want left. So I'm speaking, we've talked about right critics. I'm talking more about the left critics of AOC. Mm-hmm. Left critics of AOC will want her to do the Barbara Lee equivalents. They want her to take hard stands. They want her to fight Nancy Pelosi. They want her to do X, Y, and Z things. These are people who are sympathetic to the Sunrise sit-in and everything like that, Sunrise Movement sit-in. But it also seems like there's this degree of not understanding what Barbara Lee understood, which is when you take moral stands, that doesn't mean you're going to win. I don't think, like, it seems like there's a group of people who not only expect AOC to not play by the rules and take these stands, but then they also expect her to win by doing things. Like, these are the like force the vote people with universal health care. These are people who get mad at her for, like you said, Lisa, I love the way you put this, just being very direct. I think this thing is bad, or I think this thing is good, but then not blowing herself up over something that wasn't going to happen. So how do we just get at, because once again, like there are different, Andrea, I think you said this. I hope this was you. This is what's trouble for two different guests. There are different types of politicians, and we need different types of politicians. It seems to me the problem on the progressive left right now is that there are so few progressive leftists in Congress right now that if you're AOC, you have to be multiple types of people at once. So she has to be media superstar who's giving an eloquent speech in Texas about ICE, but she also has to work with Nancy Pelosi with backroom deals. And it seems to me, my reaction to everything you're saying is, man, progressives, elect more people so that different people could play different roles. So I mean, that, Lisa, I'd love you to respond.
I mean, I 100% agree with that. I think I think AOC would say that. She always says, like, I am one person. Like, I am one person. You cannot put this whole movement on my back. And the more progressive politicians they elect, I mean, if you look at the squad, like they hold different values and priorities within them. They are not a like uniform entity, right? They have different, they vote differently sometimes because they have different priorities. They come from different districts. They have different backgrounds. They're friends and the media has made them a thing, but like, exactly. Let's get more of them so that they're allowed to represent different things and disagree and have, you know, like they should.
Someone does a sit-in and someone's negotiating with hard-edged backroom deals.
It's insane to think like, well, they're the squad, so they all have to be together all the time because they all have brown skin and they're all working class and they all came to Congress at the same time. Like that's just like insane. You wouldn't say that about four other people anywhere. Like, anyway. And the other thing I would like to say is that, you know, the internet eats people, right? So our attention spans are so insanely short. So we love you, AOC, and now we're totally over her and she's like screwing up all over the place and like she's saying the wrong thing. She's wearing the wrong clothes. And like her hair is wrong and like her shoes are wrong. And like, you know, and that happened in the space of whatever, 2 years. And that's just the churn of the internet, the way we like consume and spit out people's. So she's like not doing enough for us, but like in a way that's just the tempo of how we're living now and the way that we like consume and digest and like regurgitate everything so insanely fast. So that's just like a separate thing. And you can accuse her of like, you know, she rode that horse for a really, really long time. And now like she's.
Events happen. And yeah. You can't ride that same horse anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say too that like, you know, we as a society, not only American society, but I think humans in general love to have heroes and love to have people who we project like all of this, right? Like they're like our martyrs, they're like our Jesus. And that is not how things work, right? Especially in a place like Congress. And I think with her too, like she was elected to represent a district and she's very committed to making things well for her district because that's first and foremost her job, right? And when these tensions happen, I think that, you know, it's almost like her critics sometimes ask her to sacrifice that in pursuit of these bigger moral issues that are core to her political identity. And that's like a very high wire act. I don't know how she does it. I don't know how anyone can do that sustainably. But over and over, and especially during the pandemic, what we saw is like her commitment is with her district in New York, like was something like what, three of the hardest hit zip codes at the beginning of the pandemic were in her district. I used to live in Astoria. I was not in District 14. It's like Maloney represented me. But things were not good in our neighborhoods in Queens and in the Bronx. So to her, I think like especially over the past 2 years, that was like her first and foremost commitment. And one of the reasons when Bernie lost the nomination and Biden became the nominee, she put her, like, she regrettably, like, she was not super happy about it, but she still supported him because for her, it was like a matter of like, this is what's morally right. If we want to get out of this situation, we need to make sure that there's a Democratic president in the White House, even if it's someone that, like, as she has said before, in any other country of the world, that we're not being the same party. Because at the end of the day, you know, even if he does not have the same stance as she does, she saw it as like a morally right thing to do for people in her community and for like the rest of the country.
So here's the last question that actually comes from what you just said, Andrea, as she isn't a messiah. We seek messiahs. You know, the internet pushes things in a certain direction. So to what end is AOC's social media? Because whenever we see coverage of AOC, she's a social media master. She does all these different things. But as we talked about with the authenticity debate, it's not quite clear to me that social media mastery not only helps you accomplish your goals, but also doesn't reinforce that messiah, I have a parasocial relationship with you, and therefore I put all your hopes and dreams in you mm-hmm. dynamic. So just to close off from the two of you, whoever wants to go first, to what end is social media? Because this is, I think, the part which is the most like news you can use for anyone who's young, trying to run for office left, right, and center.
I guess I have a couple of things to say. She did this incredible interview that I recommend to everybody with Ta-Nehisi Coates in January of 2019 at Riverside Church. And it was a really long, sort of casual interview. And he asked her about this. He was like, I worry about the social media of it all and that you're too reflexively going there and sort of stooping to the, there's a sort of lowest common denominator aspect to the way conversation happens on social media. And she said, well, first of all, social media is a place to reach people who aren't reached by regular politics. So I won in New York 14 because I was able to reach people who were either alienated from the process or hadn't voted for a long time or were too young to be, you know, engaged, and social media helped me there. And the other thing I'll say is, like, we may not like it and we may have critique of it, but social media power is real power, is actually real power, because she can raise just a ton of money in a really short time. And with that money, she wields a lot of political power. People are afraid of her. She can get herself reelected. Like, that is real. And those are small dollar donations. That is not corporate money. And the way, if you watch the way she just like eviscerates Ted Cruz, for example, on social media, like, she has this vision of flipping Texas in the next 4 years. And I think that social media will be a real tool for that. God, I mean, no one has bigger problems with it than I do, just as a way of talking. I like things to be complicated. I like things to be nuanced. I like to go slow. I like to go long. Like, I just, it's not my place. But I think it's like kind of fuddy-duddy-ish, boomerish to call it out as the problem, because it just is the tool we're using now, and we have to be real about that and like see it realistically for what it is.
Yeah, I agree that's a tool that she uses, and it's not the entirety of her power. And I think in ever since she was elected, but especially over the last 2 years, she has really moderated and like pulled back a little bit from the rapid fire, just like, you know, every 5 minutes tweeting situation like she was at the beginning, right? Like, I remember when she was elected, it was like every other day, AOC claps back against TK person, or like, look at what AOC tweeted. Like, look at how she dragged this person. And I think that in the same way that she has grown as a Congress member and like really tapped into having strategic relationships with her colleagues instead of just alienating herself completely, right? I think in the same way that she's a strategic about like what media she goes to, she's become more and more strategic with how she chooses social media. Part of it is because, you know, anything that she says became like a huge story and became really distracting. Even if she did not want to, people were talking about like the clapback instead of the issues that she cared about. And especially after last year and like the very real threat to her life, I think that she's just become more conscious of how to use that social media power strategically and as a tool and not as something that's like the entirety of her persona.
Very well said. Andrea, Lisa, thank you so much for joining. The book is Take Up Space, The Unprecedented AOC. I was telling them before we started, the cover is really great. So if you like decoration for your bookshelf, this is a high recommend. Thanks so much for joining the show. I really appreciated this.
Thanks for having us. It was really, really fun.
Thank you.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.